a decadent empire, inefficient, incompetent to a great extent, and unable to do anything to restore its own power over Latin America. There was some fear, however, that the Holy Alliance of Russia, Prussia, and Austria might move against these newly formed states in order to try to subjugate them once again to Spain. The problem at the time was that the powers of Europe were very deeply disturbed by the recent events on the continent, the French Revolution, and the aftermath of the French Revolution. Their fear was that any kind of independence movement would lead to a worldwide desire on the part of people to find independence of their rulers, their monarchs. And so they felt that whatever their personal differences, it was necessary for the great powers, the monarchs, to come together to oppose any move anywhere in the world by any people to overthrow the power of an empire or a monarchy. They felt there was a dangerous current abroad of revolution, and hence their desire to move against any group that had declared its independence of Spain. There was thus a very real problem. On top of that, one of these three powers was Tsarist Russia. You will recall that yesterday, when we dealt with the fact of the number of flags that have flown over California, we saw that one of them was Russia. There was some fear also that Russia would attempt to expand its powers along the Pacific coast. And therefore, the Monroe Doctrine was promulgated. Now, the Monroe Doctrine has, until fairly recently, remained as one of the cornerstones of American foreign policy. It does not have the status of law. It was never approved by Congress. There was no need to approve it. It was simply a presidential statement, together with his Secretary of State, to the powers of the world. However, although the Monroe Doctrine has never had any legal status, its power in American history has been considerable, in that it has been a summary statement of basic American policy. The Monroe Doctrine has, in essence, four main points. First, the Monroe Doctrine declares that there shall be no future colonization in the Americas, North, South, and Central, by European power. Implied in this, of course, was the idea that any foreign power was barred from the Americas. At that time, there was no possibility of some Asiatic power being involved. So, in essence, the idea was the Americas belong to the Americas. That therefore, any attempt by Spain or any combination of foreign powers to interfere with these newly established Latin American states would not be permitted by the United States. Then, second, no attempt would be permitted to extend the European political systems to the Americas. Now you see, this is a little different from saying that no European power will be allowed to colonize. What it in effect means that we were not going to permit their political ideas to be propagated and furthered in the Americas. To illustrate, this would mean, if applied in our time, that we would not permit, say, communism to take over any of the Americas. In terms of the Monroe Doctrine, we should not have tolerated Castro's coming to power because it meant that a Marxist state allied to the Soviet Union now had established a beachhead in the Americas. The same would have been true during the 1930s of any attempt to establish Nazism or fascism in the Americas. This means, of course, that we've not been too strict about establishing this policy in recent years. As a matter of fact, as we shall see, to all practical intent, we have abandoned the Monroe Doctrine. But, first, no colonization. Second, the political systems of Europe cannot be adopted in the Americas or allowed to extend themselves to Americas. And third, we promised, however, that we would not interfere with existing European colonies. Thus, we said, we will not interfere with the British colonies, the Dutch colonies, the Spanish colonies, or any existing ones, so that any colonies that still remain belong to the mother country, and we will not interfere. Thus, in a sense, we were saying we recognize the status quo. Now, in a sense, we did not abide by this somewhat later. What did we do to interfere with one colony? One aspect of an empire. In fact, we went to war over it. Could anyone think of what war we fought with the European Empire to help free one of their colonies?
Spanish America.
Good, you didn't fail me. The Spanish-American War. Now, we had various excuses, and we won't have time to go into that, but we did claim that there were extenuating circumstances in that war, so that it was not a violation of the Monroe Doctrine. And yet, it can be argued that in the Spanish-American War, we did not abide by our promise to avoid interference with existing European colonies. Then, fourth, in the Monroe Doctrine, we declare that we are not concerned with Europe's quarrels. If Europe is having a war and a quarrel, a division, we declared we are neutral to it. We are not involved, nor do we intend to get involved. This, of course, makes clear what we have done in recent years to the Monroe Doctrine. In World War I, we did get involved. In World War II, we got involved. In the Korean War and in the Vietnam War, we became involved in foreign affairs, foreign wars. And in our diplomatic policy, we have been involved in the Suez Crisis and in a number of other crises in recent years where we are definitely concerning ourselves with European quarrels and with the quarrels of various powers of the world. So, to a very real degree, the Monroe Doctrine is now no longer operative. Not because any foreign power has violated it, but because the United States itself has consistently violated, especially the latter part of the doctrine, this fourth point. Yet ironically, we have not abided by our pledge with regard to the second point. For example, Chile was taken over by a communist regime. True, it was voted in, but it was very closely allied to foreign Marxism. In a very real sense, it involved a violation of the Monroe Doctrine. And yet, we abstained from action in the name of non-interference in foreign affairs, when at the same time, we were involved in a foreign war in Asia. So the Monroe Doctrine, a very remarkable step in the diplomatic position of the United States, was undercut and to all practical intent nullified by the United States itself. This is why, although you know about the Monroe Doctrine, unless the country changes drastically in the next 10 or 20 years, your children may know very little about it. It may be a forgotten doctrine, dropped out of the history books because nobody is concerned with it. It's dead, and it is a part of our history that perhaps no one will bother to remember. This has happened to the Polk Doctrine. President James Knox Polk, P-O-L-K, who was president from 1845 to 1849, promulgated the Polk Doctrine. Now, it is important for us to deal briefly with the Polk Doctrine to understand what it means. We touched upon an important aspect of European policy and politics when we dealt with the balance of power. To review briefly, balance of power politics is that type of politics where various powers are determined that they shall have the ascendancy. They shall have the primacy on the continent of Europe. And if any other power begins to rise to challenge them, they will help a third power gain additional strength in order to attack the second power. The idea being that your rivals are to cancel each other out. We saw how Louis XIV used the balance of power, how Britain especially is the dominant force in Europe for some time, used the balance of power to destroy the old French monarchy, then to destroy Napoleon, then in World War I, or even after the destruction of Napoleon, to destroy Napoleon III when Napoleon III became very powerful, to destroy Kaiser Wilhelm and his German Empire, to destroy Nazi Germany after Nazi Germany had arisen to power as a result of their manipulation, and also to foster, with Churchill's famous Westminster College speech, the Cold War between the USSR, the Soviet Union, and the US. Now, the Polk Doctrine is concerned with this balance of power politics. At that time, Texas had become an independent country. Territorially, Texas has more than enough power to be an independent country. It is bigger than many nations in Europe. But territory does not determine strength. Resources, industrial capacity, and other factors do. As a result, Texas, while technically an independent country, in reality did not have the ability to remain independent. Texas was mostly cattle, a small amount of farming. Its resources were limited. The government could not exist very well in those days in particular without foreign subsidies. Now, one of the interesting facts is that immediately Texas had all kinds of friends. As a matter of fact, Britain was ready to lend all kinds of money to Texas. In effect, what the British policy would have done would have been to make Texas more or less a branch of the British Empire to all practical intent without any violation of the Monroe Doctrine. Texas would have been so financially dependent upon Britain. The Texas policy would have been dictated by British policy. Texas would have been involved then in the balance of power politics of Europe. It would have meant that whenever Britain needed to exercise any pressure on the United States, it would have a lever right down in the southwest in Texas. This posed a tremendous threat. It meant that without colonizing and taking over Texas, Britain now had a tremendous means of using force against the United States, exercising pressure. Polk was immediately aware of the threat. Moreover, President Polk recognized that there was technically no violation of the Monroe Doctrine, so that he could not say to the British government, "You have violated the Monroe Doctrine and we protest." Of course, the British government could always say, "We don't recognize the Monroe Doctrine," and been accurate. But on the other hand, the British government knew that a policy of the United States that had been laid down as their basic policy with regard to the Americas, if they did violate it, it was going to mean some kind of conflict and trouble. But by financing Texas, by using this roundabout means, they were not violating the Monroe Doctrine. So Polk declared, as the Polk Doctrine, the other great cornerstone of American foreign policy in the last century, "No country in the Americas can be involved in the European balance of power politics." In other words, not only are the European powers to stay out of the Americas, unless they already have a colony, but they cannot involve the Americas in the balance of power politics. That's the Polk Doctrine, very simply, but extremely important. Well, again, we destroyed the Pope doctrine. We got ourselves involved in a number of things where the balance of power was at stake. Theodore Roosevelt was the first to do this. Does anyone know what war he involved us in without military action on our part, but to intervene, to protect one country from defeat, to establish a balance of power? This is not an easy question. Do a little thinking. Theodore Roosevelt charged in as the peacemaker and saved one country that had won early victories from radical defeat and made a great nation out of it, when previously it had been of no consequence in the world. This was early in the 1900s. Yes.
Did he save Russia from the Germans?
No. You're partly right about one of the countries involved, Russia. What war was Russia involved in? Anyone think? I've given you half the answer. Doesn't anyone know? Don't you know? What? No, it was before, some years before. The Russo-Japanese War. Yes. The Russo-Japanese War. Now, what happened in this war? In the Russo-Japanese War, which was fought, of course, on the Pacific coast, the Japanese attacked Russia. Well, not necessarily the case, but the two countries went to war. And immediately, the Japanese took the attack. Russia, because its center was in Europe, had a real problem in getting supplies to the Pacific coast. So, in the early stages of the war, Russia took one staggering defeat after another because it was so far from the battle line. Now, the results were quite disastrous to Russian morale, as well as to Russian prestige all over the world. Russia was one of the great powers of the world. And here, a little far eastern country, up until now of no consequence in world affairs, was beating them badly. However, as the war progressed to a certain point, it became very obvious that Japan was going to be overwhelmed. Why? Because the Russians were slowly getting the men and the equipment across Siberia. And as they moved this vast amount of equipment and men across Siberia to the war front, it was clear now they were going to be in a position to overwhelm and to defeat Japan thoroughly. The great powers did not want this. Their attitude was that it would be nothing short of a disaster for Russia to defeat Japan and to have the door open to taking a big fight into China on the next go-around. And so their feeling was, we have got to do something there. We've got to prevent this Japanese victory from being turned into a defeat and a collapse. Therefore, some kind of interference should take place here. And so they prevailed upon Roosevelt, who foolishly felt that it was a great honor to be asked by the nations to play the role of a peacemaker, to step in there and stop the war before anything further happened, in the name of world peace. And so Russia was stopped by pressure from the great powers and the United States from going any further and turning a defeat into a victory. Since then, we have made the same very serious blunder, and we have saved a country from radical defeat. Does anyone know when this happened? This time it was the Russians who asked us to do it. This was not too long ago. We played peacemaker and created no end of trouble. Yes. Egypt, yes. In the Israeli war just recently, at the very first, things went badly for the Israeli because they were caught by surprise. Then things began to turn around. The Israeli armies were marching toward Damascus, and especially in Egypt, they had crossed the Suez. The Egyptian armies were in panic and in flight. Egyptian resistance was collapsing, and there was nothing to prevent the Israeli from overwhelming all Egyptian forces. So at that point, when we didn't fully appreciate, because we had such poor intelligence, we didn't fully appreciate how far gone the Egyptian situation was, we stepped in at the request of the Soviet Union and saved their friend Egypt. And at that point, Kissinger was made into a total fool, and Nixon as well. Now, the only thing we gained out of it was that the Arab powers, instead of being grateful to us, promptly hit us with an oil embargo. So it was a thorough act of stupidity. And it was a violation of our historic foreign policy. So you see, yes?
Military aid to Israel also a violation of our foreign policy?
Not necessarily. If we sell them things on a cash basis, on an economic basis, we maintained that right to trade in the War of 1812. Now, there was another famous example in the last century of an attempt by foreign powers to violate both the Monroe Doctrine and the Polk Doctrine. And its real purpose was, in effect, to destroy the United States. Does anyone know what that attempt was? This is an extremely important thing. Very, very important. It concerned Mexico. What happened in Mexico during the Civil War? Yes. True. Now, who were they using as a front there? Yes. But what individual? Who became emperor of Mexico during the Civil War? Did I hear someone? Yes. Maximilian. Good for you. Now, when we became involved in the Civil War, One of the immediate results was, of course, that there was a great deal of European support for the South. This support was not premised on any feeling of sympathy for the South or being pro-Southern. The whole point of the European support for the South and the hostility to the Union was, this young country, the United States, is getting too powerful. If we see it split, and if we help it to split, we will keep this country from becoming too strong. And possibly it will help us again to treat the Americas as an area where we can interfere at will. In other words, we can nullify the Polk Doctrine, we can nullify the Monroe Doctrine, we can treat the Americas as open country. As a result, when the war continued and it was apparent that there was not going to be a quick victory, that it was going to be a long, drawn-out affair, that possibly it could lead to Union defeat, the powers of Europe, Britain, France, Spain, Austria, and others, exclusive of Russia. This time Russia did not go in. The Tsar was pro-American. Supported Maximilian of Austria. Maximilian was sent to Mexico with an expeditionary force of foreign troops to be made emperor. Now, Maximilian was a naive soul, and he sincerely believed what his foreign advisors kept telling him. The Mexican people love you. You're going to be the great benefactor of Mexico. They need a wise and intelligent ruler like you. As a result, later, when the foreign troops were pulled out, Maximilian was foolish enough to believe that the people there wanted him. Well, they wanted him to kill, so they promptly executed him. And his empress, Carlotta, who had taken the ship and gone back and went from one court of Europe to the other, pleading for help for her husband, lost her senses and lived insane the rest of her life. I believe she died in the 1920s. And this was in the 1860s. However, Maximilian was sent to Mexico with foreign troops. And the point was that he was to build a base there from which not only was there a threat to the United States, but if and when the war ended, a weakened United States could be very easily challenged by the foreign powers from Mexico with highly professional foreign troops. The threat was very real. As a matter of fact, in much of the Union, the feeling was that the country was finished. That irrespective of what happened in the war with the South, which was underway, the Union was finished. That the European powers through Maximilian were going to destroy the United States. Now there were good grounds for such fears. But what happened? Yes? Right. I think I discussed this once with you a few years ago. Yes. The Tsar sent the Navy to sea with sealed orders. One fleet, the Pacific Fleet, was told to go to San Francisco. The other was sent to ports on the Atlantic, Boston and, I believe, Washington, D.C. Well, consider what this meant when a great Navy landed at both ends of the United States. The accounts of the day tell us that when the fleet landed, Americans in Boston, San Francisco, and elsewhere met the Russian sailors with tears. Women were going up and kissing the Russian sailors and crying, "We've been saved, we've been saved." And with good reason, they had been. The Tsar had actually saved America. And this instituted a period of very great friendship for a long time with Russia on the part of the United States. Because at a critical point in our history, when the foreign powers were ready to destroy us, the Tsar of Russia had come to our rescue. Now, when this happened, the immediate reaction of the foreign powers was, we cannot do it. Because we have a power behind us there, Russia, to the east of Europe, with its vast army, and we have the Russian fleet there in San Francisco and on the Atlantic coast. So they immediately gave orders to their troops in Mexico to withdraw. They withdrew, and the result was the collapse of Maximilian's government. He was urged by the foreign advisors to leave the country, and he said, "No, my place is here with my people. They love me." Well, he was immediately taken prisoner by them, and Juarez refused to allow any quarter to be given to him, and his execution took place. Now, there was another thing that Russia did for us at that time, and we did for them, apparently, as a favor. So it was to be a mutual favor, to indicate their friendship. Does anyone know what this other Russian act was? Yes. Yes, the purchase of Alaska. To indicate their cooperation and their feeling that the United States should have the future determination of this continent, Russia offered Alaska for sale to us. And we, as a favor to Russia, to indicate our appreciation of what they did, bought it. Now, even then, as you recall from your U.S. history, there were Americans who criticized what they called Seward's folly to have bought that vast hunk of ice, Alaska, which turned out to be one of the greatest assets the United States had, the gold rush in Alaska, the fur, and so on, and now, of course, an even more important asset in terms of our present energy crisis, Alaskan oil. The wealth we gained there was enormous. And all of this is a part of the Tsar's feeling of the necessity of defending the United States. The extent of influence this had on this country was so great that even when the Russian Revolution took place, there were many people who were ready to be friendly to Lenin and his regime because the sentiment in America was intensely pro-Russian. Russia was our friend. That was the feeling. And indeed, in the last century, Russia did demonstrate itself to be one of our greatest friends. This in spite of the fact that we had, under Theodore Roosevelt, done Russia more than a little damage in the settlement of the Russo-Japanese War. Now we'll stop for a few moments for questions. Are there any questions? When does this period end, by the way? I keep forgetting. 10 of. Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. My dad.
Dad said that he's going to be able to come to the thing this week.
What?
My father said to tell you that he wouldn't be at the thing this week because he has a passage, but he might come Friday.
Oh, very good. Concern now is with voluntarism and reform. Voluntarism and reform. We have been dealing in our evening classes with the principle of voluntarism, whereby after 1740 and the Great Awakening in particular, instead of things being handed down from above by statist action, the American principle as it developed and became a unique contribution to world history was for voluntary action from the grassroots springing out of faith, out of the convictions of the individual man, so that churches created not as established churches, state supported, but supported by the people. Various reform movements, schools, everything, instead of state established, representing the faith and the convictions of the people. As a result, a wide variety of reform movements in the early half of the 1800s began to spread, and for better or worse, became major forces on the American scene. Of these, perhaps the most conspicuous was the anti-slavery movement. Now it is ironic when we examine the origins of it, how insignificant it was. The most fanatical, the most extreme of the anti-slavery or abolitionist agitators was William Lloyd Garrison, who published The Liberator. He was so extreme that even those who were anti-slavery were very angry and embarrassed by his activity. They felt his extremism discredited the entire movement, that there was no future for the anti-slavery movement when rabble-rousers and hotheads, extremists like Garrison, took it over. When some of the first issues of The Liberator in 1831 came out, Southerners who first encountered them went up in smoke because Garrison was so extreme. Garrison made it clear that the only thing that mattered to him was freedom. On one occasion, he publicly burned a copy of the Constitution to express his contempt for a document that allowed slavery to exist. In one way or another, the public acts of Garrison were extremely offensive. But when he first began, the issues that the Southerners picked up so upset them that they wrote to the mayor of Boston to protest the kind of rabble-rousing activity of William Lloyd Garrison and the Liberator. Now, Otis, when he received the letter from the South, was very puzzled. What was all this talk about Garrison and the Liberator? He'd never heard of either one. So he did some investigating, and he found that there was one man with a handful of colored ex-slaves operating in a little cubbyhole of an office on next to no funds, issuing these papers from time to time proclaiming the gospel of abolitionism. He was very relieved, and he wrote a letter to the Southerners saying, "You have nothing to worry about. Here in Boston, we didn't even know this man existed. And I assure you, he is nobody, and there is no one who follows him." However, the startling fact was that within a few years, some of the finest young men from the most important families in Boston were reading and following Garrison. And Garrison's influence was spreading everywhere. The influence of Garrison in the abolitionist movement, instead of being insignificant, became tremendously important. Because Garrison, as an extremist, hit savagely and hard on the issue. He made even people who disliked him intensely feel a little bit guilty because they weren't making an all-out stand on a moral issue. His power, as a result, grew enormously, in spite of his extremism, or perhaps because of it. Garrison, in other words, was pushing ideas to their nth degree. He was demanding that people take an either-or stand. And as a result, he became progressively a powerful force on the American scene, in spite of the fact that his following was never too great. I'd like to read now a few things from the first issue of The Liberator, which appeared as a weekly paper, January 1st, 1831. Garrison wrote, "In defending the great cause of human rights, I wish to derive the assistance of all religions and of all parties. Assenting to the self-evident truth maintained in the American Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, I shall strenuously contend for the immediate enfranchisement or freeing of our slave population. I am aware that many object to the severity of my language, but is there not cause for severity? I will be as harsh as truth and as uncompromising as justice. On this subject, I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation. No, no. Tell a man whose house is on fire to give a moderate alarm. Tell him to moderately rescue his wife from the hands of a ravisher. Tell the mother to gradually extricate her babe from the fire into which it has fallen. But urge me not to use moderation in a cause like the present. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch. And I will be heard. The apathy of the people is enough to make every statue leap from its pedestal and to hasten the resurrection of the dead." Now, this is strong language. And it in particular began to spread rapidly among a segment of the population in New England in particular Does anyone know where its appeal was? Does anyone know the kind of following the abolitionists had? It was among the Unitarians, the Transcendentalists, the Rationalists, the various people who had no gospel, who, having abandoned the historic Calvinism of New England and having moved into a Unitarian faith of varying forms, no longer had a real gospel. But they hungered for some kind of word to proclaim to people, a word of freedom, a word of liberation. And so it is they looked to various things as a new gospel. For Horace Mann, the new gospel became state control of schools. Horace Mann proclaimed the saving power of the common school or the public school. He visualized a future in which America would be crime-free, prison-free, free of all moral and social problems. How? Through the state schools. He imagined that people looking back a century later would think that people in the 1830s lived very primitively and crudely, because by that time, under the enlightening and blessing influence of the state schools, crime would disappear, poverty and ignorance would disappear, and people would live in peace, prosperity, and happiness. What had happened? For Horace Mann, government control of schools had become the new means of salvation. Now, the Unitarians and Transcendentalists went into one movement or another seeking salvation. These movements by the Unitarians attracted their zeal and their fervor so that they had all the passion of the old-time Puritans, ready to go out and conquer the world, only not for Christ now, but for their faith. What they did was to take the Puritan attitude which still lingered in their midst and to transfer this into a totally secular, totally humanistic context. And so, Garrison could say, on this subject I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation. Subsequently, abolitionism became so powerful in Unitarian circles that a group of very, very wealthy Unitarians formed a council, the Secret Six. The Secret Six was made up of six very wealthy Unitarians. Then a second six was made up of Unitarian thinkers, of whom Emerson was one. Emerson was a part of the secondary six. It is interesting, and I refer to this in Nature of the American System. One of the Secret Six was a very wealthy Unitarian who was also a Unitarian minister, although usually not in church work, because he didn't need to work. Thomas Wentworth Higginson, a very powerful man, who once said he always had money for treason. He was influential in the support of Horace Mann. He was influential in the support of abolition. He was influential in the support of, can anyone think of a man that the Secret Six used? Not too far from here. What? John Brown. John Brown, a hoodlum and a killer. John Brown was financed by the Secret Six to start a war. To try to start a war. Because they felt the best thing that could happen for the cause of abolitionism and centralism or socialism would be a war. And they were right. And the sad fact is that John Brown failed at Harper's Ferry to start a war. And the South Carolinians foolishly did John Brown's work for him when they fired on Fort Sumter. Now, this was one of a number of movements. Another was Dorothea Dix's movement for prison reform. Dorothea Lynde Dix was a New England woman, a Unitarian like the others, who got herself involved in reform. Her name was so famous, incidentally, that another woman picked it up some years ago and created the Dorothy Dix letter column for a long, long time when I was of your age. The most popular column in the United States was the Dorothy Dix column, which was like the Abigail Van Buren and Ann Landers column, like the two combined. Everybody in the United States read the Dorothy Dix column. Well, the woman who adopted that name had borrowed it from the original and the real Dorothea Dix. Dorothea Dix began to visit prisons, poorhouses, institutions for the mentally disordered, and began a reform movement to improve these prison facilities, which were often very poor. And she, in January of 1843, presented a memorial to the Massachusetts legislature in which she pleaded for the correction of the abuses. And she did get action out of the legislators. She wrote, "I come to present the strong claims of suffering humanity. I come to place before the legislature of Massachusetts the condition of the miserable, the desolate, the outcast. I come as the advocate of helpless, forgotten, insane, and idiotic men and women, of being sunk to a condition from which the most unconcerned would start with real horror, of beings wretched in our prisons and more wretched in our almshouses. Men of Massachusetts, I beg, I implore, I demand pity and protection for these of my suffering, outraged sex. Fathers, husbands, brothers, I would supplicate for this boon. But what do I say? I dishonor you, divest you at once of Christianity and humanity. Does this appeal imply distrust? If it comes burdened with a doubt of your righteousness in this legislation, then blot it out. While I declare confidence in your honor not less than your humanity, here you will put away the cold, calculating spirit of selfishness and self-seeking. Lay off the armor of local strife and political opposition. Here and now, for once, forgetful of the earthly and perishable, come up to these halls and consecrate them with one heart and one mind to works of righteousness and just judgment. Injustice is also done to the convicts. It is certainly very wrong that they should be doomed day after day and night after night to listen to the ravings of madmen and madwomen. This is a kind of punishment that is not recognized by our statutes and is what the criminal ought not to be called upon to undergo. the confinement of the criminal and of the insane in the same building is subversive of that good order and discipline which should be observed in every well-regulated prison. I do most sincerely hope that more permanent provision will be made for the pauper insane by the state, either to restore Worcester Insane Asylum to what it was originally designed to be, or else make some just appropriation for the benefit of this very unfortunate class of our fellow beings. Now, this is the kind of thing that abounded in that day. One kind of moral reform after another, some good, some bad, but influenced by the spirit of voluntarism as it was carried outside of the Christian fold into the Unitarian and other circles. Another such movement was the women's rights movement. In 1848, there was the Seneca Falls Declaration and Resolution on Women's Rights. Now, there was some cause for the women to feel distressed. In biblical law, I deal with the movement and I point out how, after the War of Independence, the laws with regard to women went downhill, and a woman was progressively deprived of all her rights, so that a woman could be literally robbed of everything she inherited by her husband, and she had no recourse. The condition was truly an ungodly one. And it is to the shame of the churches of the day, who had been so caught up in emotionalism that they did nothing about it. And it remained for the secularly minded to do something about it. But even then, these women who did work on it were, while justified in a great deal of what they did, operating on humanistic and equalitarian premises. Now, the Seneca Declaration is very interesting in that it was in effect a copy of the Declaration of Independence of 1776. I'm going to read it to you because I think it is so interesting, and yet, in spite of its equalitarian ideas, much that it had to say about what had been done to women was true. When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one portion of the family of man to assume among the people of the earth a position different from that which they have hitherto occupied, but one to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes that impel them to such a course. We hold these truths to be self-evident: that all men and women are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of those who suffer from it to refuse allegiance to it, and to assist upon the institution of a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. And then it goes on to speak of the long train of abuses and usurpations, and to declare that such has been the patient suffering of the women under this government, and such is now the necessity which constrains them to demand the equal station to which they are entitled. And then they go on to give a long list of complaints and resolutions. In a sense, it was justified, despite their equalitarianism. Because the women could say, as they did say, some of us are well treated, we have good husbands, but as far as the law is concerned, we are, to all practical intent, the moment we marry, slaves. We've been stripped of all legal rights. And in the eyes of the law, we are like children, incompetent. Wherein are we different from the black slaves? After all, many of the blacks have good masters who treat them well, who are very earnestly concerned about their welfare. So many of the masters are like many of our husbands, good masters. So we're not complaining just because some masters are bad that slavery is wrong, or because some husbands are bad that the situation is wrong, but that in principle, the enslavement of women, stripping her of all legal rights, reducing her to the status of a minor who is mentally incompetent and whose affairs, whose money, whose wealth, whose property immediately passes to her husband when she marries, is without justification. Now, at this point, they were clearly in the right. The condition of woman was not a product of Scripture. It did not exist in the Middle Ages, nor did it exist in the colonial period. It was a product of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment deified reason. And when it deified reason, it saw man, the male, as reason, as though somehow more rational than women are. You still find this attitude surviving. I don't know whether you've seen the movie My Fair Lady. If you haven't, you've missed a real treat. It's a delight. And there's a song in it that goes, why can't a woman be like a man? And Professor Higgins goes on and on. Why can't she be sweet and reasonable the way men are? Why can't she be sensible like a man? And so on and so on and so on. The whole thinking being, just in line with this, men are reasonable. There's no problem until they tangle with a woman. And women are so unreasonable. And of course, this is the thinking of the Enlightenment, that reason is the property of man and emotions are the property of women. And in terms of this, because the Enlightenment deified reason, it put man firmly in control and said, well, since the woman represents emotion, she obviously is incompetent. Now, there is nothing like this in Scripture. What Scripture does say is that while the man is the head, doesn't mean necessarily he's the smartest. A man may be an officer, and there may be a lieutenant under this officer who's smarter than the officer, but the captain is still in charge. You may be a lot more intelligent than the pilot who's flying the plane, but he's still in charge of the plane. There's a principle of authority. So, in the church and in the home, the man is given authority over the woman. But it's not the authority of a king over a slave, but the relationship is as a king with his prime minister. And if you want to see the kind of authority and power and dignity the woman had, look at Proverbs 31. A very competent woman, a wise business manager who can handle her husband's affairs and estate. But with the Enlightenment, all this has changed. And the result of this kind of thing, the worship of reason, and the downgrading of emotions, and saying that women somehow didn't have reason, just they were just emotional creatures. A woman became something that was incompetent by definition, and therefore was consistently downgraded. We still have a great deal of this kind of thinking amongst us. We haven't wiped it out of our minds, because habits of a couple of centuries of thought, habits of thought for two centuries, do not disappear from a culture immediately. But the effect of this was deadly, and it led to the enslavement of women, their total deprivation of rights. There are one or two states where this type of thing is still on the books, and rather ungodly things happen. For example, a woman whose husband was an alcoholic, no account, immoral, who deserted her, and yet she didn't have the ability to get a divorce in terms of some of the laws in the state, because for desertion so many years of waiting were required. She went to work, built up a business, and began to make a life for herself and her children, and her husband was able to walk in after several years, take all of that, leave her with nothing but the clothes on her back, and it was entirely legal. Now that still prevails in certain places, unless it's been changed in the last year or two. But this kind of legislation, in particular in those areas where the European influence was the strongest, Texas law with regard to women is very bad. Some of the eastern states still have it. The further west you go, the more the woman has a better status. But some of the old laws from the influence of the Enlightenment still prevail in some of the eastern states. I don't know what's like in Pennsylvania. It could have been changed in the last few years. The laws of Pennsylvania used to be very unfair to women. Very unfair. As a result, the women's rights movement had a great deal of justification. And it began to make great headway, but because the nation became involved, as a result of the Civil War, in a long war, and then after that, all the problems that ensued, Reconstruction, conflict over that, the women's rights movement was shoved to the side. And it took the beginning of this century for it again to get underway, to be able to command public interest. Then I have referred already to another one of the reform movements that represented a new gospel for the liberal Unitarian tradition, Horace Mann and his ideas. I'd like to read a few verses from Horace Mann's report, 12th annual report to the Massachusetts Board of Education in 1848. Indicating what he expected the public schools to do. He wrote, "Vast and overshadowing private fortunes are among the greatest dangers to which the happiness of the people in a republic can be subjected. Such fortunes would create a feudalism of a new kind, but one more oppressive and unrelenting than that of the Middle Ages. Now surely nothing but universal education can counterwork this tendency to the domination of capital and the servility of labor. If one class possess all the wealth and the education, while the residue of society is ignorant and poor, it matters not by what name the relation between them may be called. The latter, in fact and in truth, will be the servile dependents and subjects of the former. But if education be equally diffused, it will draw property after it by the strongest of all attractions. For such a thing never did happen and never can happen, as that an intelligent and practical body of men should be permanently poor. Property and labor in different classes are essentially antagonistic, but property and labor in the same class are essentially fraternal. But the people of Massachusetts have, in some degree, appreciated the truth that the unexampled prosperity of the state, its comfort, its competence, its general intelligence and virtue, is attributable to the education more or less perfect, which all its people have received. But they are sensible of a fact equally important, namely, that it is to this same education that two-thirds of the people are indebted for not being today the vassals of as severe a tyranny in the form of capital as the lower classes of Europe are bound to in the form of brute force. Education, then, beyond all other devices of human origin, is the great equalizer of the conditions of man, the balance wheel of the social machinery. I do not here mean that it so elevates the moral nature as to make men disdain and abhor the oppression of their fellow men, but I mean that it gives each man the independence and the means by which he can resist the selfishness of other men. It does better than to disarm the poor of their hostility toward the rich. It prevents being poor. Education, in other words, Horace Mann, will save mankind. Men will be saved by education. Therefore, if we emphasize education, strip it of this nonsense of the Christian presuppositions which clutter up our schools, this was his implied premise, we will thereby change the world, beginning, of course, by changing this country. And so the school, this was the means of salvation. Of course, there were other gospels of salvation that were very popular in the day. Socialists, Fourierites, flourished. They attempted to establish communes all over the country. Owens and his experiment. The Oneida Colony, sexual communism, the Brooks Farm in New England, one experiment after another whereby man was going to be saved by a new social arrangement of people, by communistic ideas, by sexual reform, one way or another, salvation. Of course, we have these things again today, the Sexual Freedom League, the New Left, the communes. We again have these same beliefs, voluntaristic in principle, but not having the gospel, seeking the gospel in some social arrangement, in some environmental factor. Again, we had other ideas of salvation, gospels propagated by various groups, having a variety of plans of salvation. One of them we have with us today in the name of a particular food, the graham cracker. The graham cracker gained its name from a man named Graham, who believed that he was going to regenerate mankind through certain kinds of foods. As a result, there were a wide variety of cultists, whether it was food or something else, They were going to save mankind by this means. There were some who believed that the only way to renew man was to avoid extremes in foods, anything that was too hot or too cold. Therefore, ice water was bad for you, and soft drinks were bad for you, and tea and coffee were bad for you. Not because of the ingredients, that of course is knowledge we have since acquired about some of those things, but because you should avoid the extremes of hot and cold. Such ideas, as I indicated, became extremely popular, and one group after another arose on the American scene, especially in the 1840s and 50s, with one wild idea of reform after another. Now, these groups were especially popular in the cities and among the people of intelligence who had, as a result of their education at Harvard and other schools, lost their faith. And having lost their faith, they were looking around for a new gospel. They very often came up with some very, very ridiculous ideas. Someone wrote a book on one aspect of this period, which he titled The Mad Forties, because there were so many of these salvationist ideas that were the height of absurdity. Are there any questions now? We still, of course, as I indicated, not only have this, but such movements are very, very strong with us today. And they do a great deal of damage sometimes, even to good ideas. We have health food cultists, as they did then, who do a great deal of harm, for example, to the very important nutritional ideas that health foods do offer us. And we have the environmental people with their ideas of salvation by going back to a supposedly perfect, untouched environment. Well, if there are no questions, we'll continue this evening.